if you'll forgive me for standing up, I've been sitting on a plane for 12 plus hours, as I described it on the LL massage special, meaning that there was a baby sitting next to me kicking me the entire trip. So thank God the baby's fine, I'm okay. Rabbi Kelman asked me to speak about repentance, and specifically Rav Kook. Rav Kook's a very difficult person to get a handle on, a grasp of. When you look at the writings by Rav Soloveitchik, it's like reading a building, a floor, it's an edifice of carefully constructed arguments, proofs. Rav Kook, on the other hand, can be best compared to trying to put your hand out and catch the wind that blows by. To say he was prolific is one thing, but to understand the way his mind works, his writing was much more a stream of consciousness to the extent that when his son came in after his levaya and went into his study and looked at his desk, you could see the writings on the desk that had overflowed the page. He would just start to write, and his hand would go beyond the borders of the page. He would never use a pen, because to use a pen meant back then to do what? You had to stop to fill up the inkwell. For that, his writings are interesting enough in pencil, because it just flowed out of him. Thoughts and ideas. And what I wanted to do today was look at something that we're all very familiar with, come back to a couple interesting and perhaps possibly new explanations of, and then go into Rav Kook's thought through the back door. And what I'm referring to is the eating of the fruits and the foods on Rosh Hashanah at the beginning of the meals, the simanim. We all know that if you're a low-carb diet person, Rosh Hashanah is not the holiday for you. You have with all the fruits that you're eating and all the honey, all the carbs adding up. You have all these vegetables, all these fruits, and the question is, where does it come from? It's originally a Gemara in Kritot on Daf Vav, a Gemara in Horiota and Daf Yud Bet, which says that Abaye says, now that we know that a siman, a sign, has value, we should eat simanim, we should eat signs to ensure ourselves a good year. And he gives a list of five vegetables, the gourd, the cucumber, the bean, all of whom their Aramaic names have some significance, have a little play on words. A karat becomes kore, to tear apart the bad din. Gezer, carrot, becomes gezar dinenu, to destroy the, rip up the judgment against us, etc. And this custom becomes widespread in both the Ashkenazic and Sephardic poskim, and it's brought as halakha. Several new ones are added. The Ashkenazim add the heads of fish and the sheep to remember Isaac, and that we should be like the head and not the tail. Both Ashkenazim and Sephardim interestingly separately bring in the apple. We'll come back to that. Some people in Israel have the custom. Some people, interesting, now have the custom to eat the following three fruits. The gefen, teina, the rimon, the pomegranate, the grape, the fig, and the dates. Where did these three fruits appear in Tanakh? In the story of Yotam. In chapter 9 in the book of Judges, when Avimelech takes power in a coup, killing off his brothers, and becomes Israel's first king. We always think of Shaul as the first king of Israel. But the first one to take power was actually a man named Avimelech several generations beforehand. Avimelech was not appointed by God, as Shaul was. In fact, this is simply a power grab. It's a coup d'etat. He kills off his brothers, except one. The one brother, Yotam, gathers the people together before Avimelech's soldiers can trap him, and says, let me tell you a story. When the trees voted to have a king, they went to the grape. Will you rule? And he said, who am I to rule? They went to the fig. Will you rule? Who am I to rule? They went to the pomegranate. Will you rule? Who am I to rule? Finally went to the bramble bush and appointed him king. And it was the fire from the bramble bush that would just consume and destroy them all. An allusion to the fact that, in fact, ruling is not the role of people, is not a position people should aspire to. Real kingship, real judgment is in God's hands alone. And those that aspire to leadership, aspire to power, aspire to rule, are nothing more than the thorns that we have to confront. And for that reason, in Israel nowadays, there's a custom to eat these three fruits together. so that we should, as it were, we don't want rulership for ourselves. We don't want dominion. We only want that God, like the fruits said earlier, we want that you should be involved. But there's two fruits I want to come back to. The first is the apple. Why the apple? Where does the apple appear? Interesting, the word apple appears 12 times in Tanakh. 6 times as a tree, not as a fruit. 5 times as a place name, and 1 time as a person's name. The fruit apple, tapuach, in itself never appears. The Zohar brings it for the first time, saying that a good apple, what makes a really good apple? The tangy flavor. It's a little hint of bitterness, a little sour taste. And just as we dip it in honey, says the Zohar, so too should the judgment against us be sweetened. Rabbi Nachman, however, says something absolutely fascinating. He first says, and I'm quoting from his meditations to the Rosh Hashanah Eve, the Kavanot. He says, why the apple? His first suggestion, I don't know if this is botanically true, but he says the apple, the fruit comes out before the leaves are finished. Now, to go in the incorrect order, says Rabbi Nachman, that can only be a reference to who? The Jewish people. Because we said, Naseh before Nishma. It's an interesting allusion in of itself, but I want to develop his second thought. And therefore, my son, when you eat the apple dipped in honey, remind yourself of the devastation caused by the eating of the first apple, by the king's second in command, referring, of course, to Adam and the Eitz Hadat. Somehow, says Rabbi Nachman, eating the apple is to remind us of the sin of Eitz Hadat, the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge, done by Adam HaRishon. Now, if we go back to the Talmud, on what day did Adam eat the apple? Answer? Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is not the beginning of the creation of the world. That occurred in accordance to that opinion on the 25th day of Elul. Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, is the beginning of the creation of man. And man was created on the first day, and he sinned on the first day. Says the Chatzim Sofer, had he managed to hold on to for a couple hours, he would have been allowed to eat the apple when it was Shabbat. And we'll come back to that theme and develop it further. So our eating of the apple, says Rabbi Nachman, is, as it were, a tikkun, it's repair for the original sin of Adam's eating the apple. It's a fascinating thought. First and most because Jewish sources never mention or try to identify Eitz Hadat as the apple. This is, to the best of my knowledge, until I saw Rabbi Nachman, and I only saw this 3 days ago, this is at best something that first appears in Christian Renaissance thinking. But Rabbi Nachman identifies it as it. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov is the mystic, the Hasidic mystic of the beginning of the 19th century, whose name has been famous in bumper stickers in Israel ever since. And he adds another detail. Take the apple and dip it in honey. Because honey is the pure brought forth from the impure. The tahor brought forth from the tameh. What does he mean? The bee's not kosher. It's the only foodstuff where I can extract a product from an unkosher animal and the product itself becomes kosher. So Rabbi Nachman, that is the power of teshuva. The ability to take averot, the ability to take sins, and not just the raisin, but to pull from them their essence so that they become merits, they become turned for the good. The tahor from the tameh, and that is the symbolism of honey. It's interesting. If that's true, then I'm wondering why the apple is somehow meant as a tikkun for that tree on Rosh Hashanah, and I want to know why. But before I do, I want you to allow me a 2-minute little detour, as it were. The tour, when he lists all the fruits, he throws one other one in. He says, you remember you should eat the head of the fish, the head of the lamb, the bean, the carrot, the gourd, the apple, and don't forget to eat the etrog. Now, I can understand that at $65 to $100 a pop, we don't do that. Okay, that custom has probably fallen out of favor if for no other reasons. But the Torah says, what fruit must we remember to eat? We should eat the etro. Not after Sukkot though, on Rosh Hashanah night, you have to get yourself two. If your etrogs last that long, I'd love to know how you do it. He doesn't give a reason. It's interesting. Of all the ones that he gives, he always says, you eat this, yitamu sonenu, yigzor gizar dinenu. He doesn't give a reason for the etrog. And the question again, why? Okay. You're connecting two thoughts. I want to go with the first and second, okay? The first was the etrog is known as a beautiful fruit. It's known for its taste and it's known for its smell. So the Pri Chadash there in the Shulchan Aruch says, if you remember the Midrash about the lulav and the etrog, there are four species. One has taste and smell, one is without taste and without smell, one is with taste without smell, and vice versa. And together they symbolize all the types of people in the world. There are those with learning but who cannot put into practice. There are those who practice good deeds without learning. There are those with neither learning nor good deeds. And then the etrog, of course, symbolizes the tzaddik who has both. So it says the Pri Chadash, the etrog makes sense. We should aspire to be at a level where that we are both full of Torah and good deeds. But I want to come back to the second point. The Talmud, in trying to search for the identity of the mysterious Eitz HaDaat, does not point to the apple. In Sanhedrin, it lists possibilities. When is man most likely to sin? When he first can digest wheat, so it must be wheat. No, grapes. When man drinks, that's what drives a man to sin. So it must have been a grape. No, when it's figs, because the figs is the first sweet food they used to give children. When you first doing things that are above and beyond what's required, it must have been the fig. Says Rabbi Abba Vako, no, it was the etrog tree. And what's his proof? And the woman saw that the tree was good for food. Tree that's good for food. What should it have said? The fruit's good for food. What is the only tree where the wood tastes like the fruit? The etrog. The etrog tree, if you suck on it, you can taste the etrog in it. And in text, it's called pre-Eitz Hadar. It's not just a pre-Hadar, a pre-Eitz Hadar. It's a fruit where the taste of this fruit is so effusive, it permeates the tree. Now that sounds like a very strange reason to identify it as the tree of knowledge. Until we come to one of the most fascinating midrashim that we often skip by in Rashi. The Son of God created the world. And we generally assume that the world was obedient. How can somebody disobey a creator? Rashi says in chapter 1, however, there was one act of rebellion, as it were. In chapter 1, verse 11, it says as follows, and I'd like to just read the Hebrew so you can catch the... Vayomer Elohim, Tatsheh Aretz Desha, Esef Mazria Zera, let the earth bring forth vegetation. I'm on Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph, chapter 1, verse 11. Eitz pri oseh pri lemino. What should it be? A tree that is a fruit tree that is capable of producing fruits. Does anybody have any problem with that, the wording right now? Apparently not. God wants fruit trees. He's not an Atkins failure. He likes his pomegranates, he likes his cherries, he likes his oranges. There's nothing wrong with some healthy fruits, and that's what God wants in this world. All of a sudden, however, we come to verse 12. Vatotse ha'aretz desha. That's exactly what God asked. The earth gave forth vegetation. Esev mazriya zera. More vegetation, more types of grass and herbs. But what's missing now? The eitz oseh pri. Eitz oseh pri, but not. It says, I'm sorry, aser zarobo leminehu. Again, that its free species is accepted. But missing there is the word. Eitz pri. Instead of making an eitz pri oseh pri, It's only an Eitz Oseh Pri. Instead of a fruit tree bringing forth fruit, is now just a tree bringing forth fruit. And that change in wording, that subtle disappearance of the word, causes Rashi to bring the following midrash. It says, Rabbi Shalom, the earth was disobedient. It disobeyed God's command. For God commanded that it should bring forth fruit trees bearing fruit. Meaning that the tree itself should have the taste of the fruit. And the earth did not do so. And the earth gave forth vegetation and trees bearing fruit. Only the fruit was edible, but not the tree. It's a very strange midrash. God apparently asked of the earth to bring forth trees that were that not only could produce fruit, but the taste of the fruit was in the tree, and the earth could not, and the earth refused. The problem with this midrash, at least on a logical level, is to disobey falls in the realm of moral behavior, choice. How can an animate object, the earth, disobey? Dimar Ral, the Gur Aryeh Rabbi Yehuda Loi, in his commentary to Rashi, says as follows. He says, this wasn't disobedience, as we tend to associate it. What it meant was that the physical world could not completely fulfill God's command. The physical world is not perfect enough to be able to produce fruit trees where the taste of the fruit are involved. It wasn't, as it were, that God had somehow, that the earth actively chose to disobey. It's just the nature of this material world. That removes one problem, but it still leaves the Midrash very puzzling. And now that we've raised all sorts of questions, I'd like to bring in Rav Kook. Rav Kook builds a chapter of his work, The Lights of Tshuva, Orot Tshuva, on this thought. And I'd like you to, we're going to read through this passage several times, as it were, listening to the original wording once, and then starting to develop the thoughts and themes and unpackaging the ideas within. At the beginning of creation, it was intended that the tree should have the same taste as fruit. This is simply quoting the Midrash, quoting Rashi. All the supportive actions that sustain any worthwhile spiritual goal should be experienced in the same feeling of delight as the goal itself is experienced. It's a little bit wordy. In English it says, when I take actions toward a goal, not only should I enjoy the goal, but the steps leading to the goal should be enjoyed. But earthly existence is that we only enjoy the final step. Only there do we experience all the pleasure and the splendor of what we try to accomplish. The tree which bear the fruit has lost its taste. It's an interesting equation. Translate, listen to this word again, but let's change the wording a bit. If fruit equals goal, or ends, and the tree equals the means, and taste is somehow the inspiration, the excitement, the pleasure that I get from accomplishing something. How does Rav Kook read into the Midrash? The goal that God wanted for this world is that what? When I set out on a journey, when I try to accomplish something, I have a goal in mind. I'm a new teacher. I have my teaching certificate. I'm going to change the world. I'm excited, and I'm looking forward to this, to transforming everyone around me. And all of a sudden, I walk into my first class, and please open your books. Please open your books. Did you bring your books? What do you mean you don't have a pencil? No, you can't go to the bathroom yet. And all of a sudden, as exciting as the goal was, the means to that goal, somehow you lose the enthusiasm very quickly, that inspiration, that excitement. I'll use another example that might be familiar to some of you. This doesn't have to. A wedding is a wonderful experience, but not many people would want to be engaged too often. Because all the planning, this color, that color, okay? You know, you'll speak first. No, they'll speak first. No, we need this many people. We need this many guests. This, all the excitement. Sometimes you can maintain the goal in mind. Sometimes we can maintain it. We can maintain the enjoyment of what we're looking forward to. But sometimes in life, it doesn't work. When I was teaching in Hebrew school this morning, I just came from Beth Tikva. And I asked them what the most common resolution in America is on January 1st. It's of course, the second is to stop smoking. The first, lose weight. Okay? And every January 1st, what happens? There are people who wake up, this year is going to be different. The inspiration's there. They're looking in the mirror, 20 pounds, they've already brought that size zero dress. I don't know what a size zero dress is. I don't know if that means you don't exist anymore. But it doesn't, but I don't know, but they're there. They've got the inspiration, they've got the goal set up in mind. You open the leftovers on January 2nd, the turkey, the chocolate cake, the yams, I don't know what. After a week, you can't hold it. And that's the nature of life. Says Rav Kook, what is this midrash teaching us? The goal of life is somehow that it's not just the ends that matter. It's not just the fruit that should contain the taste. Because life is not just about fruit. There's also a tree involved. Something that provides support, a structure for us to arrive at the fruit. These are the means. The ability that we can have to look at the means and recognize the taste, the inspiration, the excitement, not just as a means to an end, but within the means themselves, can you imagine how wonderful that would be? Because most of what we do is not a goal in and of itself. Most of life is the process, the trying to accomplish something, the attempt to go towards a certain goal or ideal. But that's not what, but that's most of life is not the end of the journey. Now, this is an interesting interpretation. It's a very wonderful tree. It's inspiring. It explains why the Etrog then becomes the one tree that Adam cannot have yet. Because it is the one tree that actually can achieve that perfection. And if Adam is meant to struggle for a bit before he reaches that, then to reach for that is to rush too quickly. But then, if it's that simple, Rav Kook's works would not have caused the controversy that he does. In another section, in another one of his writings, and I think these writings are gathered by him, the Mamrei Riyah, he uses the same passage, but instead of substituting ends and means, he substitutes the words Kodesh B'chol. Originally, all of life was meant to be Kadosh. All of life was meant to be holy. Somehow, somewhere along the line, the nature of life is that we cannot do what? See the holiness in everything. The whole, which is the tree, that which is profane, that which appears to us not to have any spiritual value, at best is only a support for that which is holy. We go through 6 days a week, but thank God we have Shabbat. And that's really the traditional Jewish approach. The dichotomy, as Maimonides says in the chapter, in his 8 chapters, his introduction to Pirkei Avot, what he calls the Shmoneh Parakim, the 8 chapters, Maimonides says, sleep in itself has no value. This coming from a person who spoke about that he himself only slept 2-3 hours a night at most. When does sleep have value? When I sleep to do what? So that the next day, I can engage in Torah study, I can engage in kind deeds, prayer, mitzvot. The sleep only gains value when it is meant to support something else. There's a discussion in Psachim, on Daf Pet, where Abai and Rava argue, a shliach mitzvah, on the way, does he have to worry about danger? And Rava says, no. You're on your way to do a mitzvah. And what happens when you come back? The Gemara asks, well, what happened? Okay, you're done. You're going back. So Rava says, I don't know. Find a mitzvah to do at the other end. Nice, good Jewish answer, right? It's what I call the eat bread answer. Whenever I ask my rabbi, I'm not sure the brach on this thing, and he wasn't sure either. Don't worry, eat bread, you'll solve everything. It's a nice, good Jewish answer, but it doesn't quite get... Somehow the secular only appears to have value in relationship to that which is holy. If it's there to support that which is holy, then it has value. Now Rav Kook, however, has a different view of holiness. Rav Kook suggests the following. There's holiness in everything. And here you can hear the mystic in him speaking. The problem is we aren't always able to perceive it. And I'll use his wording, to taste it. Only at certain points can I look at the holiness. And I'm able to perceive it. And those are the days. If I taste holiness in Shabbat, then I'm not just tasting the holiness of Shabbat, but I'm also tasting the holiness of Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. That holiness that's in the week becomes perceivable on Shabbat, but it's still there. It's still hidden. I just can't taste it. It's still the tree. It's not yet the fruit. But he then, if you've heard this Mishnah, a person studying, and he looks up and he says, wow, what a beautiful flower arrangement in the back. Looking at these beautiful vases back there, what a beautiful arrangement. Says the Mishnah, you forfeited your existence. What a powerful thing. Apparently because you've left that which is holy for that which is mundane. Says Rav Kook, the Mishnah says the forfeiture does not come about because you interrupted your study, but because when you looked at the flowers, you couldn't perceive, you only perceived their physical external manifestation. You couldn't perceive the holiness inside them. If, however, you could, then it would be perfectly fine. Now, all this sounds very, very theoretical. But there was a lot of practical ramification to what Rav Kook was dealing with. Rav Kook lived at the turn of the century, the 20th century. He came to Israel in 1905. And he's confronted with a situation that most people, that nobody had ever confronted before. For the first time in history, there was an organization, an attempt to build a society based on Jewish values, but secular Jewish values, however they were to be defined. And the immediate reaction of those who were in rabbinic leaders, the religious leaders, for the most part was to do what? Who needs them? They're not holy. They're not Kodesh. They're Chol. To turn to close the doors of the Beit Midrash, we'll stay here in our centers of learning and we will not be involved. Some people join the Mizrahi organization, which is the one that represents the religious Jews in the Zionist movement. But it's interesting, most of the leaders of Mizrahi at the time did so not out of ideological reasons, but out of practical reasons. When Herzl in 1903 presented his plan that to make Uganda the new Palestine, he only had one body of support, the Mizrahi organization. Because the leader Mizrahi at the time said, there's so much danger, we have to take whatever we can get. Rav Kook couldn't understand this. Because Rav Kook was looking at it from a different point. Since you know, the last name Kook was one he gave himself. It stands for what? And it really stands for the epitome of what he tried to accomplish. Kook is Kuf Vav Kuf. It is Rosh Hashanah for Kodesh Kedoshim, the Holy of the Holies. What does that mean? It's a very interesting name to give yourself. Alright, some people give themselves doctor and, you know, what does it mean to be announced, to be introduced at a luncheon? And now Mr. Holy of Holies himself will speak to us. I won't say anything about my in-laws on the day after Rosh Hashanah, but this is, what does it mean? In Rav Kook's thought, it has a very import very, very significant connotation. He wrote, and I'm quoting again from the book Mamre Riyap, page 399. I'll be glad to give the sources to anyone afterwards who's interested. The purpose of disclosing the secrets of the Torah. At the time, you know, the Kabbalah then meant something very different than it did nowadays. Okay? Kabbalah meant mysticism. It meant very secret. It was still very hesitant. How dare you teach people who are not initiated, who aren't complete? Why teach this? Rav Kook said, why would I teach this? Because it gives me one skill that I would not have otherwise acquired. And I want to spread that skill. To view the secular from the vantage point of the holy. To realize that in truth there is nothing totally secular in this world. It's a very broad statement. In mysticism it makes sense. Mystical thought which sees God everywhere is by definition antinomianism. It does not antinomianism, nomian Greek for law. How can you make distinctions? If this is holy and this, if everything's holy, how can one make distinctions? Says Rav Kook, all these concepts come together. Holiness and secularism are separate on one vantage point. But when I look at them from the vantage point, the holy of holies, then I see a unity. I see something that I didn't see before. There is nothing secular in this world. And it was this that led him to look at the secular Zionist movement and say, how can it be that a movement that calls itself secular, that claims that it's not connected to tradition, how can it be that this movement, of all the movements that are in the Jewish people, this is the movement that is rebuilding the land of Israel, the mitzvah of mitzvot? The question that everyone has to answer is, how does one relate to this? And Rav Kook says you have to look beyond the surface. You have to go deeper. If you see people sinning, look deeper. It's not a question of their reality, it's a question of your perception. You have to perceive the holiness in what they're doing. Now, practically, it's a very dangerous line to draw. Essentially, you're saying there are no lines. Because if everything is holy and it's just a question of perception, then what is required of us? What are we supposed to do? Do all mitzvot fade away? Do all the distinctions that we draw? We know that we ability to divide is not just the way we start the week, it is the way God starts the creation of the world. God divided between night and day. God divided between the land and the sky, between the earth and the sea. Rav Kook deals with this in several places, most notably in his siddur on the prayers of Havdalah. We start with an act of Havdalah, he says. Havdalah is the act of division. Dividing between that which is holy and that which is secular. And in another place he writes, the world suffers from the mixture of Kodesh and Chol without order. Where there's opposition and confusion can't ascertain what is holy and what is quote-unquote secular or profane. All the labors of the wise must be discerning the boundaries and values. The first step is to understand what is holy and what isn't. And so the same Rav Kook who spoke so lovingly of the pioneers could still walk arm in arm with Rabbi Sonnenfeld in 1914 to each yeshuv in the land, to each settlement that was being built, and speak to them, please keep Shabbat. The difference is that his approach was not keep Shabbat or else. Keep Shabbat because this is the punishment that we follow you. Was keep Shabbat. Because you don't realize what you are doing is so holy. And if you only understood the value of your actions, you would run to keep Shabbat. You would want to keep Shabbat. You wouldn't be plowing on Saturday. You wouldn't be engaged in farming 7 days a week. Precisely because what you are doing is holy. Says Rav Kook, we start with Havdalah. But Havdalah is not Hafradah. Hafardah, as we now know from the political lexicon in Israel, means to separate. Okay? The big call, every party now has it. How will we separate ourselves from the Palestinians? The difference between Havdalah and Hafradah is the boundary between them. Is there a Geder Bitachon? Is there a wall that cannot be breached? Or is it simply an act of doing what? Recognition. This is what's important. This is what's closer connected to reality. This is what is of true value. This is only a way to get to that. It contains within it the holiness, but it is not holy yet. It says, Rafuk, we start with Havdalah, but we end with Kiddush. And he quotes something I've seen before in the Chatam Sofer. It's a fascinating wordplay. How do we begin Kiddush? Vayer Vayboker Yom Hashishi Vayechul Hashmayim Varz. And all the if halachic literature has this tremendous question: how does one interrupt a verse? How do you begin with the verse? Says the Chatam Sofer, and it's echoed in Rav Kook's thoughts, because there's something I'm trying to accomplish here. I'm willing to break the verse up because of a word game. Really? Yom Hashishi Vayechulu Hashamayim. The first four letters, the first letter of each of the first four words are Yud, okay, Vav, okay, the name of God. Says Rav Kook, notice something. We don't bring in Shabbat when Shabbat comes in. When do we bring in Shabbat? If you're in Jerusalem, 40 minutes early. Otherwise, 18 minutes early. That's called in Halakha, Tosefet Shabbat. What are we doing? Adding from the Chol and turning it into Kodesh. We start the week with the act of Havdalah. But if we've gone through the week properly, we should be capable to it's no longer Havdalah, but Tosefet Shabbat, the act of turning from dividing between holy and profane, between kosher chol, to converting the chol to kadosh. Now, let's go back to what we've said. What is repentance? Repentance is the ability to look at what we have and do it from a different light. I'll finish with the Rav Kook quote, and this summarizes what we said. Every defect is destined to be mended. We are assured the day will come in creation we turn to its original state, when the taste of the tree will be the same as the taste of the fruit. For us it means two things. From his first explanation of this passage, a passage alluded to because both the apple and the etrog, which symbolize this perfection, this level of perfection, which symbolize this level where means and ends are indistinguishable because they both can, I can perceive the value in what I'm doing in and for of itself and not because it's going to lead to something else, where I can understand how important each and every step of the process is, not just because it leads to somewhere, but because this is where I am right now. That which is symbolized by the perfection of the etrog and or the apple, and I think that's what it means when it says the fruit came before the leaf, that there's a balance between that which produces the fruit and the fruit itself. That, says Rav Kook, is what we have to strive for. And says Rav Kook, if we go to the second interpretation, one step further, the ability to look at the tree and see the holiness inside it, is it? To see beyond the exterior, to recognize the taste. We start with Havdalah. We start with distinguishing between that which is pure and impure, Tara v'tameh, Kodesh v'chol. But our goal has to be, says Rav Kook, to get to a level we are capable of not just dividing between that which we consider to be secular and profane and that which we consider to be holy, but to bring ourselves to a level we are capable of taking that which appears to be mundane, appears to have no meaning, that which appears to be profane, and raising it up so that it becomes holy. And that, says Rav Kook, is the vantage point of not the love of Kedusha, but of Kodesh Kodeshim, to go into the Holy of Holies, which is what we strive for, and which on Yom Kippur, when we are able to see everything in its complete wholeness and oneness and unity. Gemara Chatima Tova to everybody.